Hello, I'm Munkan McGann, and you're very welcome to the Big Adventure Podcast. This week we're looking at, how am I going to put this, people for whom age just doesn't enter into the equation. Donald Attig is a boat builder, explorer and adventurer from Illinois originally, living now in West Cork for the last 20 years. At 71 years of age, he is still adventuring and describes himself as full of spit and vinegar. Josh Lynam, widely acknowledged as the father of Irish mountaineering and general guru of the outdoors. He is 82 years of age. Josh has published many books on walking in Ireland and is a general editor of the Irish Walk Guides. Josh, you seem to be incredibly well respected. I mean, you've been given a doctorate from Trinity. Everyone I've met in this series has talked about you with great fondness. But tell me how it began. In 1946, somehow, as an enthusiastic climber, but you know, according to your own admission, rather inexperienced, you found yourself going up the Himalayas.
Yeah, well, I was totally inexperienced, but I was in India. For God's sake, I'm not going to miss up on the chance. And we went and we climbed a peak. And the other two people with me, they didn't climb it, but I had a Sherpa. A Sherpa didn't mean what it means now because they were just sort of porters and I was leading him, not the other way around. We climbed the peak that we'd set out to, but by an easier route than we'd thought. And we did another one, the two, Sonam and I. We did made a first ascent then, so that was nice.
But during the 1940s, I mean, 2 weeks ago I had Peter Byrne on, a man from Donnybrook who also ended up, he ended up in the British Army, where you ended up in the Indian Army, but saw the Himalayas and realised he had to explore them. But it was such an unusual thing. You were born in London, but both your parents were from Galway. From that Irish background, it was such an unusual thing to countenance.
Well, I got inspiration from an aunt, if you please. She took me to see a film about Kanchenjunga in 1930, and she followed that up by giving me a book about it. And now that was me for another 76 years, right?
Kanchenjunga was a famous peak that wasn't successfully climbed.
It wasn't climbed until 1954.
And what, as a 12-year-old or 14-year-old, you thought, I'm the man to do it?
Well, I was seven then.
Okay. Oh,
my God. I just thought about the Himalaya. And, you know, as far as I was concerned, the Alps were sort of a bit small, you know. Mm-hmm. And that the rock climbs which I could get in England or Ireland, you know, gee, I mean, that's just a stupid thought. But in fact, then I started back at the other end by rock climbing and then working my, having done this one Himalayan trip, I didn't get there for 12 years because, you know, it was a big deal getting to the Himalayas. I mean, an airfare single was the same price as a return is now. And I mean in exact terms. I'm not talking about inflated terms or anything. About. So, you know, it was, I think it was 3 months' salary when I went there,
right,
just to get there.
Good God.
That's good. And we drove back, actually. The others had more time and they drove out. And we drove back. And you could drive through Iran, you know, at that stage.
So you almost needed the Indian Army or the British Army or someone to help one's way back then.
Well, in 46, I mean, you know, I was being paid and as an officer, and all I had really was a train fare, a bus fare, and a couple of porters, who were cheap.
Donald Attig, you were being brought up in Illinois around the same time, the 40s or the 50s. Something made you look at the Mississippi. What was that and why?
We'd planned when I was in fifth grade with an old boat my grandfather had from his commercial fishing business. He gave it to me and we prepared this big trip to go 28 miles to Streeter. And then we discovered from Streeter you could get down to Illinois to the Mississippi, and then we discovered you could get from the Mississippi all the way down to New Orleans, and then you could even go across the Gulf of Mexico. We made all these preparations, and everybody thought it was fine, till we tried to put the boat in the water. And we used this old trailer my grandpa had made out of a Model T, and we put the boat in the water. It filled with water. We managed to get it back out somehow, got it home. He said, you got to tar it. You got to tar the boat. Between that time and the time that we got it tarred, it disappeared. I think maybe the adults who had been thinking it was a jolly big joke that we're talking about doing this realized we were serious. And then I was going to do the trip, you see. So the first chance I got years later, when I was in my 20s and I'd made enough money to retire, I built myself a 26-foot boat and retired and took it on. Became the first man from my area to ever get all the way down because there weren't any petrol stations on the river to speak of in that time. You had to go overland with 5-gallon cans and make the return journey and even go through shanty towns and places where it wasn't considered worth your life to go through.
So this was you first. You were brought up in Illinois, but it was an Irish American family.
Absolutely.
Somehow you had made enough money to retire by your 20s.
Yeah, I had a good little business venture. I developed a thing and was able to sell it for enough money where I would never have to work the rest of my life.
And then you decided you were going to take on your grandfather's dream and sail the Mississippi. What sort of boat did you choose?
I didn't see any that I liked, so I built one.
Right.
And built a 26-foot cabin cruiser with a lot of features that hadn't been put in boats before. I've always had kind of an inventive mind. That's how I made the money to retire that young. And among other things, I was after I went down to Mississippi, I was going around the Gulf, and I was living in a little Cajun village for a while where they spoke only French except for one family. Nobody was registered for the draft or taxes. And Hurricane Donna came, so I went out into it, and they figured I would all be dead. I should have been. It was a stupid thing to do. And when the storm was over and I got back in, the whole village came out and we had a 2-week party because they never thought they'd see me alive again. But it did prove the boat was designed right.
Yeah. So, Josh, when you came back from India, from being in the Indian Army, you went to Trinity. Was there people in Ireland who were interested in mountaineering at the time?
We started a club, Bill Perrott, whom I'd known in India. We started the club in December 1948. And we got a membership of 60. Now, there were 4 of us who rock climbed. The rest were all walkers. And Bill and I, we spent most of our time, or most of our weekends, it seemed to be, taking the people up climbs and teaching them to climb.
And since then, I mean, this was during the 50s, there was general interest was building up?
Interest was building up. I mean, I went abroad in 51 because when I graduated, you didn't think about it. You'd say, we'll go somewhere abroad, get a job. I could get a good job. I mean, it wasn't a question of packing a suitcase with a bottle of whiskey in the bottom and going to digging trenches. I mean, I could get a job as an engineer. But you didn't. There was nothing. There was nothing. I mean, the 50s was terrible here.
Well, am I right? You were involved in the first Irish expedition to the Alps in 1949. Is that right? That seems very late for Irish people to finally end up in the Alps.
Yeah, well, for me, I'd been 47. I mean, I came back from India in the beginning of 47 and I got to the Alps that summer. And I got there in 48. And then I said, right, this club, we're going to have an alpine meet as soon as we can in 1949. And the other thing I said was, we are going to have at least one woman. Because, you know, that's it. A woman, sure, they wouldn't be able to climb the Alps. And I finished up with 6 men, and I couldn't get a woman, but I could get my sister. I conned my sister into coming. I mean, she had been a bit. This is an awful story, but I'll tell it. We came back and that was all right. But one of the sort of less adventurous women, she said, but how could you go to the Alps? You'd be sleeping in the same room with men. And and so they said, well, you know, Joss's sister did. Oh, but she's a Protestant, right?
it does go to show there the idea of climbing mountain, of adventuring, just wasn't really in the psyche.
It wasn't. I mean, my future wife was on the next trip. Mm-hmm. And so we had a fair idea of each other. By the time you've been climbing in the Alps together, you do know something about people.
Yes.
I'm sure your family got to know quite a lot about.
Yeah, because Donald's family, after Donald, you had, you know, been inspired by your grandfather. This was from the Irish side of the family, wasn't it?
Right.
To go down the Mississippi. You did that successfully. That wasn't the end of your adventuring. Where were you focused?
It hasn't ended yet. It's only beginning. I got another 30 or 40 years to go anyway.
The thing, because you weren't mountaineering, because you had a boat, you were able to bring your whole family with you.
Well, that was a bigger boat. 3-masted schooner. Built in the middle of America under the Irish flag by permission of the Consul General, who was the Honorable Brian O'Kelly up in Chicago at the time. Never been done before.
This was a three-mast schooner you built 2,000 miles from the sea?
From the sea, 60 miles from nearest water would float it, and in the middle of an Indian trading post where you couldn't cut a tree down, it didn't look like you could get the boat out of the woods. And even when you measured it, you were sure you couldn't, except people measured a boat on the deck and the trees at the ground, and there were two trees that spread out. And so when you got it up on the low boy, you could shift it around and get it out of there. And that was the only trading post that I know of in America where they found artifacts from as far removed as Peru and British Columbia.
So somehow you decided that it was a three-mast schooner. You wanted to bring your family around the world, or where you wanted to go.
Yeah, just to travel around, one big enough to live on.
This was basically a 19th century design, was it? I mean, people weren't using three-mast schooners anymore.
No, but they're very handy because a lot of the pirate schooners used to be double-ended three-masters in the Gulf of Mexico because a boy and a man could take them back. They could outrun a warship going to the windward. They had no trouble with the merchantmen, so they'd take the merchantmen, put most of the crew on it, hang around. If a warship showed up, they'd just scuttle the merchant ship and go off on their little boat, you know, and it's a handy ship because your sails are broken to small areas.
You're listening to The Big Adventure on RT Radio 1 with me, Moncon McGann. I'm talking to people today for whom age doesn't really enter into the equation. Donald Attic is 71 years of age, or roughly about there. Josh Lynham is 82, or again, roughly around there. And both have led lives of incredible adventure and still are involved in adventure. Josh, as I say, everyone I've talked to in adventuring in Ireland talks about you, about that role you've had in all forms of adventure. But, you know, because during the 40s, during the 50s, during the 60s, there wasn't a consciousness of this sort of thing. In 1969, you set up the Irish Sports?
The Association for Adventure Sports. It was nearly like the ARC. There were two mountaineers and two canoeists and two cavers and two orienteers and two sailors, at least. Something like that, anyway.
And you seem to be the common link between all these things, between Tig Lynn, between the main waymarked ways, between this association, all of the main associations. But in 1969, what was the general attitude to these things?
That was whatever Charles Haughey did, good or bad. One thing that he did do, and in 1969, he introduced grants for sport. Mm-hmm. And that gave us the chance to set up the Association for Adventure Sports, because we could get a bit of money to get going. We were a bit mad, but not seriously mad. I mean, in 1949, we were seriously mad.
And but 20 years later, there had been a slight better understanding of these things. Donald Attic, once you had this three-man schooner built, you then decided it was time for exploring. One time you ended up in the Caribbean. Tell me about that.
Many times I ended up in the Caribbean, but I think you're probably talking about the time I went back up where the cannibals were in the rainforest.
Yeah, I like that story. I like that a lot.
Yeah, there were the cannibals in that area at the time, which is decades ago now, weren't fierce people. They were very timid. They were half starved to death. That's the reason they ate human flesh. If you didn't go to sleep or stay there after dark, they wouldn't attempt to come after you. They weren't really a threat to you. And I was wanting to try to make friends of them, see if there was maybe some way to make their life a bit better. And we went up this river that I almost named. I don't want to because I don't want to identify the island. A lot of tourists go there now.
Fair enough.
With my little boy. And got into a tropical rainforest on this island. Small size, but it is a tropical rainforest. And we, among other things, we were attacked by a wild boar. We never did see the cannibals, unfortunately. And in that area, there was an old, old coconut plantation. Looked like it hadn't been used for maybe 100, 150 years. I suppose the owners were living in England, probably hadn't seen their plantation for three or four generations. We gathered a bunch of coconuts. We also got some wild orchids that were growing out there. We had a little flat-bottom duck boat. And when we saw that dark was coming, it wasn't really all that prudent. I don't believe in taking unnecessary risks. Like, for instance, the boat I took out is supposed to be the most seaworthy small vessel ever designed by any architect. I didn't want to stay out there in a tropical rainforest after dark with my little boy. So we rowed back. We pulled this little duck boat over to rapids where we had to. Nobody had been back there in a long time. went around the bay because we were supposed to meet people in town instead of rowing out where the boat was. And they came down to meet us, and the first thing one of them said was, his name was Christian, he said, "My God, man, you bring them those pretty flower all the way from America just for us." I said, no, I picked them back on, "Oh, no, man, those, they don't grow on our island." And I named the river. He said, "Oh, no, you don't go back there. The people eat you back." He said, "The coconuts, you get them in the river." "No, you get them out of the bay." I said, "No." He said, "It was 1 year in prison for every coconut." At that time on that island, the British had just left 2 weeks before. It had been like a colony of Britain up to 2 weeks. They got their independence. The law still was, and people were starving. If you picked up two coconuts, it was 2 years in jail. Two coconuts and three limes, 5 years in jail, and no trial. Forget about it. Just straight to jail. Off you go. Wonderful system.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm really glad that we're not living on it.
When was this? What decade was that?
This was 3 decades ago.
Fair enough.
Right. Wasn't that long ago? You see, yeah. And people say, "Oh, well, we should never have had these guys like Tom Berry and all that around." Well, that's their opinion. I have my own opinion. I wouldn't want to live like that where my family was starving. If I picked up something out of where nobody was harvesting, I can see where you steal it out of somebody's backyard or off of it. But if it's nobody's and it's just laying there and you pick it up, I don't think you should go to prison for a year when your family's hungry. I don't like that kind of rule.
No, so this was the education your children were getting. How many children did you have on board this boat?
Well, we wound up with four on the boat, one born in the cottage here afterwards. I had two actually born on the boat.
It was incredible life for them. Have they flourished from that? Do they appreciate that as a way of life?
Yeah, they were. They
Are they still involved in adventuring?
In a way, they are, but not to the one that's in the biggest adventuring is in one I'd rather he wouldn't be involved in.
What's that?
He volunteered in the Army. I tried to talk him out of it, you know, and he's in a Pathfinder group. He scored number one out of 14,000 candidates. So, of course, and I said, "Don't do like your father did. Do where you don't fail. Don't fail to go on your record, but don't volunteer for nothing. Don't excel at anything. Squeak through number one out of 14,000. He's in one of these units they send into an area to draw fire for a couple of weeks so that the Army knows where the enemy is at when they go in. It's interesting.
So he's in Iraq. He's serving in the American Army.
Second tour
that,
over there.
It's an interesting concept. So that gene that he inherited from you as being this prime adventure, in fact, is a wonderful tool for war. Josh, I could almost pick any decade of your life and, you know, one has first ascents, one has first explorations. But what interests me more is, from 1987 on, during the 90s, at the age of 63, you and again with a team from Ireland, went to Tibet to try Everest from a different angle.
No, we didn't go to try Everest. We went to Changtse, mm-hmm. which is, Changtse means North Peak.
Yeah.
But it's rather lower.
It's part of the mountain range of Everest.
It's part of that
mountain
range.
The North
range.
Peak of...
I mean, and we didn't actually get up it.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a triple bypass the year before.
right. So it was an excellent time to decide to take into the Himalayas.
It was a good trip, but the weather was bad.
Yeah.
And the pair who went for the summit, they just got, it was going to be, the snow was bad, it was just going to be too dangerous. And we just had one try, otherwise the weather was hopeless, but it was a... But
it was almost the impetus for the then successful, the first Irish successful of Everest 6 years later, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. 1987, 1993. And obviously I wasn't going to be a useful member of the expedition when I was when I was 69, yes.
Yeah. When you were 67, which was in 1991, you went out and you bought a brand new high altitude tent. Am I right in that? What 67-year-old does that?
Well, I mean, it's a lovely tent. I mean, I've still got it, and I mean, we used it not for high altitude, but it wasn't simply a high altitude tent. It was a very light, well built tent. It's the best tent I've ever seen. And I've still got it now. I haven't used it for 2 years now.
Where was the last time you used it?
Touring around Europe in a car.
Very good.
I mean, in campsites, you know, with mm-hmm. Nora, my wife, and myself.
So you're still involved? You're still walking? Yeah. You're still climbing?
No, I can't.
But you walk.
You sort of saw me come in with a stick.
You had a walking stick, beautiful stick.
It is a lovely stick. I mean, I use that in Marley Park and things.
Right.
The last rock climb I did for my 80th birthday. And I did it for the research group run by my cancer consultant, John Crown, who is the best consultant you could find in Ireland. He's very famous.
You have Hodgkinson's lymphoma at the moment.
Lymphoma. Right? Well, yes, I'm in remission.
Right.
But it's not that. It's the arthritis in my knees that is the problem. No.
Is that the result of a lifetime climbing?
Yeah, partly. Yes.
And does it frustrate you that you can't?
Oh, it does. Horribly.
Even after all those decades of, you know, putting
But there's so many things I haven't done. I mean, I've never been to New Zealand. You know, that's one of my... love to have gone to.
I can't feel sorry for you, Josh, because there's so much you have done compared to almost everyone else.
Yeah, but you don't worry about... you don't think about the things you've done. You think about things that you're not going to be able to do.
Donald Attic, again, let me just tell you, you're originally from Illinois, 20 years in West Cork. This three-mast schooner you told us about, you've donated to Youth Reach in Cork. One of your greatest adventures is still ahead of you.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, to my knowledge, and the people like Tom McSweeney that I've talked to about it, nobody has ever went from the headwaters of the Shannon to the sea in a boat big enough to sleep on with an enclosed head, heating facilities and everything, without a motor, by rowing it and sailing it on the river. And, that's something nobody's done, so I want to do it.
You're now, 71, 72?
I'm in my 72nd year. I just turned 71. You know, I got a lot of mileage left in me yet.
And what sort of boat is this?
It's a little boat. My eldest son, who's living with the Lord now in his last year of his life, it was one of his boats he built in his boat company. It was a demonstrator boat. It's a cross between a Chinese river sampan and an American sailing dinghy. It's 17 foot long, but because of the bow up in the front of it, it's got no pointy ends at all. You know, it makes it difficult for a landlubber to figure out what's the front of the boat because there's no pointy end.
It looks like those sampans you see on the Yangtze River.
It does.
A big flat
and
sail.
And it's got like a Chinese type sail on it.
And you seriously intend...
I can row it. You can pole it. And I've got a reasonably modern device on it. I've got a Seagull, I think it's only about 55 years old.
Right.
And I use it occasionally.
You really intend to navigate the Shannon with this?
Yeah, I want to do it to help raise some money to buy a building for a little project that's going on in India that's taking care of street kids. And
this is your shantystreetkids.org.
Yeah, well, it's not my program. It's a woman that lived here for 12 years. She's English, but she lived in Ireland for 12 years.
And where are the headwaters? Where do you intend to start with this?
They're clear up in Ulster in a place called Loch Island. Loch Allen, I believe. That's as far up as I can get, and that's considered. I've read books that say that's the headwaters. Somebody else, you know, with any river, you get different people with different ideas about the headwaters. But I intend to go up as far as you can on that and then start coming back down.
When are you going to do it?
Next summer, God willing. You know, no tidal waves, no atomic attacks on Ireland, anything like that, you know.
And you're going to row and sail the whole thing yourself?
I'm going to attempt it. I might take somebody along with me. They have to be a senior citizen, of course.
Yeah, because you're calling this the Old Fart Challenge.
Well, that's not an official name for it, but that's it. Why not? You see, I think that people should realize that you're not dead when you're 40. Your best years can be. One of the main things is try to keep yourself healthy and active, and keep active, not to sit down and stop. You can't just sit in front of a television when you're retired. That's when you got to go out and start living. You got the time, you got the income, even if it's just the pension that are good. I mean, we have a wonderful system for old people here. We've got the free travel, the fuel allowance. You got all kinds of stuff from the government. You can have a great, great golden years.
You know? Josh, would you disagree with that? Would you think people should sit down and watch Live at 3 every afternoon? If it was still on?
Of course not. I totally agree. I mean, the only thing to do is do things as hard as you can. I mean, I managed an abseil from my 82nd birthday.
Right. Where did you abseil?
In Dorky Quarry. Doing an abseil is easy, but, you know, it sounds good. And it was a nice challenge, you know.
Josh Lynam, you're an absolute inspiration. I can't. Everyone I've had in this studio has mentioned you, just because every organization that has been supporting and funding outdoor pursuits over the last 40 or 50 years, you've in some way been involved with.
Well, I've enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy it all the time, I can tell you. But mostly I enjoyed it. And I have this stupid, really stupid thing. If I see a job that needs doing and I think I can do it, I say, I'll do it. And the other says, well, thank God, Joss is going to do it. I don't have to, right?
Donal Attig, your greatest challenge, this trip down the Shannon on a sort of Yangtze riverboat, is still ahead of you. We wish you the best of luck with that. Thanks for listening to the Big Adventure Podcast, a Mixed Bag Media production for RTE.